Good afternoon. I will call the January 29th Committee on Public Safety and Policy and Oversight meeting to order. First item is to approve the minutes from the January 27th committee meeting. Can I get a motion?
So moved.
Representative Cass made that motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
They're approved. Next, move on to the bills for the day. First one is House File 85 with Representative Junkie. I will go ahead and move that House File 85 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Transportation Finance and Policy Division. Representative Junkie, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I have a handout coming around here, too, for committee members. Should be there shortly. Members, thank you for the opportunity to present this bill. It's a fairly easy bill and what we like to call a common sense bill. In Minnesota statutes, as you can see by the bill, really nothing is allowed, for the most part, between the driver and the windshield. We've carved out some exceptions in the past, obviously a rear-view mirror. Sun visor was added. Recently, a few years ago, electronic toll collection devices were added because they hang there in the window to do the collection. One of the things we see all the time now, and take a gander as you're driving home or as you're commuting, and notice how many GPS units are out there now and how many you see either on the dash or on the lower part of the windshield mounted. And members, I believe this is a true public safety issue because I own one. I own a Garmin 360, and I have the instruction sheet from my manual here. That's the handout you got. And I could tell you from experience, so I'm testifying on behalf of my own bill, when you try and navigate your vehicle and you're looking down here to watch the roads and the turns coming up and other things, you spend a lot more time away from the windshield with your eyes than in it. So I think there was a reason that this manufacturer, instructed you where to put this unit, and I think it was put there for safety reasons. You can also read on the top, and obviously this is unscientific, it's from their manual, but it appears that Minnesota and California are the only two that have not added this to their list or allow this type of mounting for a GPS unit. So members, that's the bill. It's very simple. I've had a lot of requests for this, both from constituencies as well as, frankly, from folks right here on our own staffs and House complement who also utilize these things now. And it's a good thing. I don't have to ask for directions anymore. Not that I did ever anyway. That's the bill.
All right, Representative Jemke, thank you. Any members have questions? Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, Representative Junkie, would you be willing to entertain an amendment where I'm just a little concerned about where it says near the bottom, and they're going to be all over, stuck on everything you can imagine. Would you be interested in near the bottommost portion of the windshield tightening up just a little bit?
Sure.
Otherwise, we're going to get...
And Madam Chair, I have no question. You're right near the bottom. Obviously, when people mount them, and those that own them, actually, a lot of people do have them mounted, not knowing it's illegal, but it's way as far down as you can on the windshield, touching the dash usually. So, but okay. Yes, I would... If Representative Cornish wants to offer that, it'd be friendly.
Representative Cornish, what I'm going to do is have you repeat that language for...
Madam Chair, what's that? Oh, have the council do it? That'd be great.
Would you like to repeat that, please?
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Cornish would be amending line 1.13 by adding or inserting most portion after bottom. So it would read the bottommost portion of the windshield.
Okay, and that's acceptable, Representative.
Yep, Madam
Chair. Any questions regarding the amendment? Okay, all in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment is adopted. Any other questions from members? Okay, anyone out in the audience here to testify on House File 85? Okay, seeing none, then I will renew my motion that House File 85, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to Transportation Finance and Policy Division. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion carries.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Thanks, Representative Junkie. Next on the list is House File 145, which is Representative Hilton's bill. I will, do you want to go ahead?
Certainly, Madam Chair, and actually I believe that Representative Mullery was going to join me here as well. Representative Mullery and I have virtually very similar bills.
Okay.
I would move that House File 145 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay. Representative Mullery, are you going to move your House File?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would move House File 70, and I believe that's also to be laid over.
Okay. So the motion is that both of these files will be laid over for possible inclusion in the Public Safety Policy Omnibus Bill. Representative Hilton to the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 145, and it basically is regarding the precursors for meth. And this bill was brought to me in an attempt to get the logs available to law enforcement. And with me is Mr. Bushman from the Statewide Gang and Drug Coordinator. And I'd like to turn it over to him to talk about the bill.
Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Bob Bushman. I'm the Statewide Gang and Drug Task Force Coordinator for the Department of Public Safety. And we brought this idea forward to try to get a little change to legislation. Some of our task force officers have had difficulties obtaining information from the methamphetamine sales logs that are kept by some of the retailers around the state. There seems to be some confusion about exactly what they're supposed to do to comply. And when we took a look at the statute, when the changes were made to this a couple years ago, there was no language put in there that requires them to retain the log information that they get when they sell the stuff, and there was no requirement that they make the logs available to law enforcement. In some areas of the state, some task forces and officers had a hard time getting, and in some cases, a couple of cases, retailers have refused to turn the logs over because they believe that they're violating federal law or some protected privilege. So we'd like to see an amendment made so that it would just require them to retain the logs and then to make them available to law enforcement at their request.
Okay.
Madam Chair, and my bill and Representative Mullery's bill are very, very similar, and so if Representative Mullery just wanted to, you know, speak to his bill and kind of highlight the differences between the two, I'm fine with that, Madam Chair.
Representative Mullery, bill.
Madam Chair, there's a couple of author's amendments I'd like to make to my bill to get it in the shape to discuss it. So I would move, and this was caught by our DFL staff person, on line 3.3 of the bill, delete the line through parens F in the parens comma OR.
Okay, Representative Mullery,
I moved that.
Okay, I don't have any copies of them.
Of the bill?
Of the amendment.
Oh, it's not.
Oh, are these, you're doing these?
These are just oral amendments.
Okay. Do members need that repeated?
Yeah.
Representative Mullery, can you please repeat that?
Okay. It's on line 3.3, just taking out the line which is basically intended to mean that to delete parens F in the parens comma OR, so that there's no line through that.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions on the author's amendment? Okay. seeing none, then we can vote on the office amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Both same side?
Madam Chair, one other amendment.
Yes, Representative Mueller.
And it's on line 2.25. Delete the word after Keith and insert the above said written or electronic document. And then on the next line, delete the comma after drugs and delete the phrase to the next comma and that comma.
Okay, we're going to have you repeat that one more time so people are able to...
On the on line 2.25, delete and put in the above said written or electronic document. And then on 2.26, delete the comma after drugs and the phrase up to the next comma, and then delete the comma.
Okay. We do have questions for Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, could he read that?
Yes.
For the question in context,
it would read.
Representative Mueller, yeah, go to the chair.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
A business establishment that offers for sale methamphetamine precursor drugs in an over-the-counter sale shall keep the above said written or electronic document record of purchases of methamphetamine precursor drugs and shall make that record available to law enforcement upon request.
Okay. This is the one opportunity that a second termer really has to have some power, Mr. Kidding. Okay, any questions to the author's amendment? Okay. Seeing none, then we'll vote on the author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same side? That passes, and now Representative Mueller, is the bill in the form that you would like it?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please explain the bill.
And yes, there, as Representative Hilton said, they are similar. This came out of, I'm on the Gang and Drug Strike Force Oversight Committee. And back in October, we drafted it, and I had the bill drafted then. And we originally drafted it to 3 years, because that's the statute of limitations in Minnesota, but we did not realize a couple of things that we had forgotten. So I brought it to the next meeting, and I was corrected by the people at that meeting on the Gang and Drug Strike Force. And the attorney from the Attorney General's office, who's not able to make it today but was at that meeting, suggested that we use 5 years instead of 3 years. And there's two major reasons. One is that we want it, so because, for instance, Hennepin County turns a lot of their drug cases over to the federal prosecutors. And so the feds have a 5-year statute of limitations, so we want to make sure that these records are kept so that the feds can prosecute under it. Another reason is that under conspiracy, I didn't know that at the time before I found out in November, but if a drug is, if purchased, let's say 4 years ago, so it would be outside of the direct statute of limitations of 3 years if it's purchased 4 years ago, but then if it's put into part of some other mixing from other people and then sold, then it becomes part of a conspiracy, and that thing, the sale from the drugstore, which was 4 years ago, that can follow into this conspiracy. So the prosecutors would like it back 5 years because of the fact of the conspiracy issue. And then just in general, they also said they'd like to have it for information to look at, to gather other info when they're looking into cases on things. But the two biggest things were especially the federal statute of limitations. We want to protect it, since I know in Hennepin County, they use a lot of cases that they refer to the federal prosecutors. And then the conspiracy issue. And then the other issue that's a difference is that my bill, and it was suggested from, I believe our, I think it came, I can't remember if that came from the Attorney General or from our house research, but they suggested that we put in the clause that gives the immunity to the pharmacist, the business, and the employee who make the record available to the law enforcement, so that they for sure can't be sued, and that the pharmacist will know that they can't be sued for turning over the records to law enforcement.
And just for clarification purposes, that the immunity part is in your bill, and it is not in yours, Representative Wilson.
That is correct.
Can I, the question I have, Representative Mullery, just on that part is, when these logs are turned over, is it just the person who they are investigating information that gets turned over, or is it the whole log? So let's say somebody was being investigated, and I'm right underneath this log. So everybody's going to know, even though you're looking at person A, everybody's going to know that person B, C, everybody, they're going to know all the information on everyone else?
I believe that's the case no matter what, but Mr. Bushman is the one that actually goes out in the field and works with the police doing this.
Mr. Bushman, do you have a comment on that?
Yes, that'd be correct. You'd be looking at the entire logs. Most of them, they just have them line by line. You may have to sort through to find exactly what you're looking for, but it would be all of the logs are not sorted by person. They just show you the entire log.
So kind of like a sign-in sheet for an open meeting, you turn the whole thing over. Okay. Representative Coles, do you have a question?
I think so, Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom, Representative Mullery, I don't have any concern at all about the requirements related to the record retention for a certain period of time, and Representative Mullery, I think I'm okay with the immunity piece. I guess what I've got a concern about is, I think what Representative Bigham was getting at a little bit, and we seem to be getting kind of close to invading on privacy and private information related to people's health care. Yes, it's not prescription medication, but nonetheless, I'm not sure how I feel about law enforcement gathering.
Member, we could turn off the phone. It might be mine, though.
It's probably mine. Gathering information about my Sudafed purchases when there's no reason to suspect that I'm involved in the manufacture of methamphetamine or doing anything else. I guess I'm curious why we're foregoing a requirement for either a warrant or providing somebody with some kind of subpoena authority or power. So at least there's what I'm concerned about is law enforcement going on a fishing expedition, and I'm not sure what they're going to do with this information. And I don't want to sound like the black helicopter guy, but we had a situation not too long ago here in Minnesota with MJNO, and law enforcement wasn't terribly careful with some of the information that they received. And I don't know what my future employer might think of the fact that I buy a lot of Sudafed, but I'm not sure that it's any of their darn business either. So I guess that's if you could address that concern or that issue and help me get a little more comfortable with what's going on here.
Okay, Mr.
Bushman? Yes, Representative. It takes a significant amount of pseudoephedrine to make methamphetamine. The law is explicit about how much people can purchase. If that's all they're purchasing, there's nothing illegal. This isn't going to a database or anything like that. What will happen often is people involved in methamphetamine sales, they will do what we call smurfing. A group of people will get together and they'll go to a particular community or particular pharmacy and they'll each buy what they're authorized by limit at one store. They'll go to another store and do it. They may do it in several communities in the same day or several communities over a number of days. And then they'll collectively put the product together to use it to produce methamphetamine. In the times when we've gone to look at the logs, I mean, it's very apparent. Usually we know what we're going to look for, who we're going to look for, and when you look at the logs, it's very apparent. When you have people that are going to the same stores in the same town on the same day, or maybe to multiple stores to buy, the maximum amount. So there isn't, I believe, any danger of people who are purchasing innocent quantities of pseudoephedrine products like I have myself, that law enforcement is going to have the opportunity or the wherewithal to do anything with that information.
Representative Coles has a follow-up question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you know who you're looking for and you know where you're looking, why don't you get a warrant? so that again, I'm not suggesting that you're going to create some database tomorrow, but you know, this is private information that until 2 or 3 years ago nobody was collecting on individuals, and now they are, and I guess I just have a concern about people not quite as well intentioned as you trying to do something with it, and I'm not sure that we need to be facilitating a fishing expedition and potentially ensnaring some people in an investigation and putting their lives on hold when they bought they had three sick kids, and so they went the three sick teenagers, so they went to Walgreens and Target because they needed more pseudoephedrine than they could otherwise buy. So maybe I'm overly concerned about this, but I'm not sure that just because you want it is a good enough reason to be able to get it without a warrant.
Okay. Did you want to respond to that, or we have a couple questions here?
Madam Chair, I would just point out that your compatriot, former Representative Jeff Johnson, had the original bill, if I remember right, and we haven't changed anything in that.
I voted for that bill. I supported that bill. I still support it. I think it's done wonderful things to reduce the amount of meth that's being produced here in Minnesota. We're hearing a whole lot less about that today, and that's a good thing. But just because we've made some significant progress there, but I'm not sure we should just open this up and let law enforcement come in and get complete access to these logs without any what you're doing here would permit a fishing expedition. I'm not suggesting that that's what's going to happen, but it would permit it, absent a warrant, an ongoing investigation, and a judge saying, yeah, there's probable cause to go take a look at these things. Isn't that what we're doing? Where at least we're setting up a system where it could happen.
Okay. And Representative Hilstrom, author of the bill, would like to respond to.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It takes probable cause to get a warrant, and these logs would provide the probable cause to get the warrant to do the next step as well.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Wilson, we got a chicken and an egg thing. I'm suggesting that maybe you ought to have some probable cause before you go snooping around and seeing how much pseudoephedrine I buy. I'm not trying to be difficult here, because I think that the law passed by Representative Johnson was a good thing, and I think that law enforcement investigating and preventing meth from being manufactured in the first place is a good thing, but we still have some civil rights and liberties that we need to be cognizant of.
Okay, Representative Miller, and then we're going to move on to the two other questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Basically, Representative Coles, we aren't changing that part. In fact, most of the pharmacies are interpreting it that way. The problem is that some of the pharmacies are not interpreting it that way, and so we're going to make sure that there's no ambiguity in the law.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Zaskowski, you're up first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representatives Mallory and Hillstrom and Mr. Bushman, how's the law currently working? I understand that we've had. Can you characterize where we've gone in terms of some of the abuses that the law was originally conditioned for?
Yes, sir.
Representative Mr. Bushman?
After the law was changed, we saw a dramatic decrease in the number of meth labs in Minnesota. I believe at our high point we were 400 to 500. In 2007, the task forces in Minnesota seized 33 labs. We've seen a little increase this year. The first three quarters of 2008, we were at 41. The majority of the labs that have been investigated the past couple of years have involved people that are doing exactly what we were talking about today, purchasing over the quantity of pseudoephedrine that's allowed by law.
Representative Zaskowski, a follow-up?
No, thanks, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Cornish, you had a question?
I passed, no.
Okay. Is there any further testimony on the bill? Okay. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify either for or against the bill? Seeing none, Representative Mullery renews his motion that House File 70 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Public Safety Policy Omnibus Bill. And Representative Hilson renews her motion that House File 145 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Public Safety Policy Omnibus Bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's laid over. Sorry. Do I give the gavel back now, Madam Chair? Do I? Okay. Next on the agenda, we have the Minnesota Department of Corrections Performance Report, and we're going to start with a small description from Mr. Carter. Mr. Carter, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're going to be talking a little bit about performance measures. We'll be talking a little about performance measures, and I think this last bill is a great indication of a performance measure that the legislature, along with agencies, proposed, and we have seen the meth crimes and the meth labs drastically decrease in this state. I think it's a good way to introduce this subject. The other, I just want to say that one of the reasons that I've been, one of the things that I came up with is that the premise of performance is simple. Resource allocation should follow achievement and efficiency and effectiveness of service delivery. It's becoming very important in today's budget, with the budget crisis. A lot of states are addressing this, especially with these tough economic times. This state, too, we have the governor, leaders in both parties, members of the committee have brought up performance measures along with other issues to look at agencies this way. I think this is probably the second hearing on performance measures. The first one was, I think, last week in the Environmental Committee. I think they spent at least, one session discussing their performance indicators of the DNR. So with that, I'm just going to give you a little history. Performance measures have been around government since the 70s. Some people even say it's been earlier than that. But what they really started here in Minnesota in the early 90s. They came up, the legislature said that some of the agencies, or 22 agencies, had to come up with performance reports. I have here some of the reports from the Department of Corrections from 1994-96. By the way, this 1996 report is 123 pages on performance indicators. What happened with these reports? First of all, the legislature said that the agency should be doing them. The House had some hearings. I believe the Senate didn't even have a hearing on it, so they were sort of like forgotten. So that meant that nobody really paid any attention to the performance reports. But since then, there has always been a background of performance indicators. I think it's in the budget instructions for agencies to do when they do their budgets. And now I'm just going to bring you up to today. Today's budget preparation. First of all, there is the Minnesota Statute 16.8.10, budget preparation. I just want to read you this. Subdivision 1A says the purpose of performance data. Performance data should be presented in the budget proposal to provide information to the legislature so that the legislature can determine the extent to which state programs are successful. One. Two, encourage agencies to develop clear goals and objectives for their programs. And strengthen accountability to Minnesotans by providing a record of state government's performance and providing effective and efficient services. So, with that, that's Minnesota statute. We also have other areas where the performance is going to take place. The budget books. Some of the instructions for the preparation of the budget, biennial budget, from finance, it has key goals listed, and it says the agency should identify goals, or goals that the agency supports. They should come from Minnesota milestones, agency strategic goals, and other statewide goals. There also was a letter to agencies, January or July 10th of this year, that they were asked to comprehensively assess their program service and the cost of the programs. Governor has emphasized the need to measure progress on key issues. So what do we have right now? So basically we have three ways, I think, of looking at performance and with the Department of Corrections, since it's their performance report we'll be discussing. The budget book, that has key measures in it. It has the how effective are the services. These are instructions, once again. How is success measured? Agencies should include 1 to 3 key measurements on the effectiveness of their programs, and they should be determining, you know, what goals they are. Here is just one copy. I think you have in your folders a copy of one of the budget pages. If you're on the finance committee, there will be many more, and they will be required of all agencies. Next, we have the web page. This is the Accountability for Minnesota. It's going to have your department results. But let me just read you what the governor says about accountability in Minnesota on the first page. He says that Accountability Minnesota helps citizens follow the progress of state agencies towards specific goals. He also says that through this website, the public can track the progress that the agencies are working on toward providing the highest quality government services to the state of Minnesota. Then the last item that we have the performance report for the Department of Corrections. Now, Corrections is lucky enough probably to be the only agency, or unlucky enough to be the only agency in the state to be required to do a performance report. So this committee will be looking, I think, at the information on what Corrections is doing, their goals, their outcomes. As fiscal staff, we discussed this for years. Bill Marks, the chief fiscal analyst, and I, we always said that, what is the mission statement? What are the goals of agencies? We felt that this might be a great discussion for the policy committee. Then with the budget, what are the outcomes, how it relates to the budget, that can take place at the finance committee. And I was just looking past my notes from 1999 when I was doing some training for new members, and what to look for in the budget books. And on that training, I put agencies should be stating their mission and their narrative. Missions and goals should also be included in the performance report. Does this meet legislative intent? Are the outcome measures in the budget pages? And are you satisfied with the performance indicators and the outcome measures? Basically, Madam Chair, there's a little history there, and stand for any questions if you would like before you get into the report.
Questions for Mr. Carter. All right, members, before we bring up the department, I just want you to know that we will be looking at this as in detail as the members want. I've set aside today's hearing to take a look at it, and if we need to, I've chatted with the department, and we can carry this on until Tuesday. I want to make certain that we take a really good look. The Department of Corrections, again, is one of the few that has to do these performance measures, and I think it is the responsibility of this committee to take a look at what they're doing and why they're doing it, so that when we put our bill together, we can make certain that we can get the results that we are all looking for in terms of public safety. So with that, I'd like to bring the department up. And And I'm going to encourage members, if you have questions as she's presenting, to ask them, because who knows how long this will go, and I don't want you to have to save your questions till Tuesday in the event we don't get finished. So this is Chris Gray, Deputy Commissioner from the Community Services Department of the Minnesota Department of Corrections. So go ahead, state your name for the record, and welcome to our committee. I know this is the first time for you, so we will try to, be as kind to you as we can. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. My name is Chris Bray. I'm Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Corrections. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, representatives. Thank you for the invitation to present our performance measures today. I want to first acknowledge that we were late in getting our report to you. I think we were about a week late. I apologize for that. I know how much you have on your plates right now. I know how important it is for you to get materials ahead of time so you can read and review. I am new to this position, as the chair indicated, and I wasn't as diligent as I could have been in pushing that report through the process, so I take responsibility. Today, we will provide you with an overview of the information. I think you all have the full report. We will be brief in talking about the indicators, because we know that you will have plenty of questions and probably some concerns. Presenting with me today will be Deputy Commissioner of Facilities Lynn Dingle and Assistant Commissioner of Facilities David Crisp. We also have some of our managers here to speak to different parts of the measures as needed. We began this process in 2004 when our current commissioner came in, and we completed the first go-round in March of 2005. We involved our managers, who in turn involved their staff, so that we presented opportunities to everyone in the department to be a part of the process. And as a result of that, we updated our mission, our vision, and our goals. The goals are based on the process that we used. I'm happy to go into more detail on that process if you would like. They're based on what we consider to be good correctional practice in each area of the department, and they're based on the fact that we're trying to create a good working environment, because that's one more tool to help us meet our mission and vision. So for each goal, we develop performance measures, and I would say just right at the outset, I'm not quite sure if measures is always the right word in this case when we look at all this. I think I may be using semantics here, but I think these are indicators of what we're attempting to do in each of the areas. And then by looking over the years, we're looking at, are we getting better or are we not? So we're looking at those as guides. The critical elements of our mission actually include four key points: holding offenders accountable, offering offenders the opportunity to change, providing offenders with means of restoring their victims and their communities, and ultimately public safety, a safer Minnesota. Our vision can be summed up in the word focus. Our overarching goal is to focus on reducing risk, and we aim to do it in five areas: fostering community partnerships, optimizing best practices, creating a respectful and diverse culture in our workplace, utilizing effective communication, and through the strategic and efficient use of resources. Our performance measures are designed to help us measure, or are indicators of how we're doing from year to year. They are reviewed regularly by management. They're annually posted on our website, and in some cases, as Mr. Carter indicated, they're a part of our budgeting process. We report them every 2 years per statute, as he also indicated. I really want to...
Madam Chair. I just want to ask a question right off the chute here. You know, why are they indicators and not measures when you actually even use measures in your own slides?
Yeah.
Ms. Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, representatives, my definition of a measure is that it should show you and it should show us more of a percentage out of the bigger pool. And I think in many instances here, we don't do that. And I think as we go, we'll lay out for you why we aren't doing that, and you can come back at us with how beneficial it really is to you. But that's why I say the word indicator, because I'm not sure in every case we're measuring something. I think sometimes we're really just hanging our hat on a number, and while that number might mean something to us, it might not mean much to you or anyone else. You're not going to know always, is that a good number or a bad number? So I think the point I wanted to make by using the word indicator is that this process is really ongoing. And as I mentioned, we started in 2004. We've done a major revision for fiscal year 2009. And I would even say this revision, it's still in draft. I would even say this isn't as great as it could be. But I would say that what we're working with are some database limitations, and I think as we go, we can get better and better at that. I think our experience with performance measures can get better and better. And I also just want to point out that I think the best indicators of success are really conducted using experimental design with a control group and an intervention group. We do a little bit of that, but it's so resource intensive that we don't do a lot, and we sort of schedule it out into different areas. So as we go through this, I'll reference some of the research that we're doing, which really tells us and you what difference is CD treatment making. Is it a benefit or not? What difference is our reentry effort making? Is it a difference or not? So I just want to preface it with that by saying, you know, I don't know that these are always going to give you the full picture, and I think we would be the first to acknowledge that, but this is what we have for now. The first major area that we want to focus on is fostering community partnerships. We have two measures that we have been using to increase the number of fugitives apprehended and to restore victims and community through the use of partnerships. I'll first talk about the fugitive unit. This unit investigates, locates, and arrests fugitives who are in community supervision. So these are not people in prison. These people are out in the community on supervision. When they abscond, or when they can't be located, we want to find them, and we want to find them as fast as we can. And we give priority to apprehending fugitives who have committed the most serious person offenses, and also all level of sex offenders. The reason that this is about fostering partnerships is because our fugitive unit works with local, state, and federal law enforcement jurisdictions throughout Minnesota to increase fugitive sweeps. And I think this is an example of why I would use the word indicator rather than measure. We really can't tell you accurately that we have picked up 373 fugitives in FY08 out of a possible pool of 1,500 or 400 or whatever that denominator is. The reason we can't do it is because we aren't always picking up DOC fugitives, and we aren't always working off of DOC warrants. We are often working with other agencies and picking up fugitives that might not be a DOC, but might be somebody else's. We might all start out going after a DOC fugitive, but end up picking up other people. So it really is a collaboration. And it really would, I really wouldn't want to throw a number out to you to say this is a percentage of all the possibilities. I don't think it's possible. We also haven't set a target here like we have in some other cases. And one of the reasons is that we really would like to have zero fugitives out there to pick up. So to set a target in this case doesn't make much sense. I do want to just address briefly, though, why the number has gone down in 2008. In 2007, we think that number is higher because we did a U.S. Marshal sweep that resulted in 18 apprehensions. We believe the dip is likely due to the fact that some of our investigators were reassigned to work on cold cases. We had two vacancies in that unit for different periods of time. And there were a couple of particularly lengthy sex offender cases, two of which were located in different states. So we think that all impacts that number. One other thing I wished I had said earlier. What we're presenting to you is just what is. It really is not about why. We don't know why. So I can give you reasons that we think these numbers are doing what they're doing, but we aren't going to know with any degree of certainty unless we really dig deeper, and that's where I think the research studies that we do come in. I just want to mention one other fact that isn't in front of you, and that is that 80% of the fugitive level three sex offenders are apprehended within 24 hours of the time a warrant is issued at the DOC.
Excuse me, Representative Bingham. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know quite how to ask this, but and I'm giving you the benefit of the doubt about, you know, it's really hard to measure because of, and then insert one of your reasons. What are you planning on doing to get some measurements in there, at least? I mean, are you going to be taking a look at the structure of the team? Are you going to be looking at additional resources, technology? I mean, I guess I was just maybe a little bit of an open-ended question, but I'm just wondering, because I know this is important. It's a very important element of what you do. So I'm just wondering what measurements are you going to attempt to put in so that, you know, we can do our best to be partners in getting these fugitives.
That's right.
Madam Chair, Representative Bingham, I can't give you the answer to that question, but I can certainly get back to you. I don't know the answer to that, and I don't know if my colleagues from the institution side know it either. I do know, in looking at what we're going to be presenting in 2009, that the measure is still in here the way it is now. So it may be that we'll take a real close look at how we're going to present this information in a way that's meaningful, but I don't have the answer now.
Ms. Bray, I might suggest that it would be easy for us, much easier, if you were separating out those that you apprehended that were yours and those that you apprehended that were someone else's, because then at least we could have a picture of who you got that were yours and who else is missing that is yours versus who are someone else's that you did in addition to what were yours. Ms. Bray.
Madam Chair, thank you. I appreciate that, and I know we're taking notes on this. We really come here with the idea that we know we can improve on this, and we welcome any ideas. And if there are specific things that you or the members would like to see, that's what we'd like to hear.
All right. Further questions from members on this? All right. Ms. Bray, please continue. I think there was a part on that slide that I wanted you to talk about, because I had a question about the next part. There was a number of offender work hours on the previous slide.
Correct, and that's, Madam Chair, Representative, that's what I have back on the screen. Our second goal is to restore victims and communities through partnerships. As you're probably all aware, restorative justice is a philosophical framework that focuses on a response to crime by understanding and repairing the harm of crime. So crime is viewed as a violation to the victim and to the community, and as a result, whenever appropriate, we hold offenders accountable to their victim and to the community. And I really would stress the words whenever appropriate. Offenders are encouraged to right the wrong they've committed and to take action to repair the harm. That's the fundamental idea behind this. Each facility provides offenders with opportunities to attend restorative classes and groups while they're incarcerated. But it's what we're showing you here is it's through our work with local partners that we operate several restorative programs in the community that really engage offenders in productive work assignments while giving something back. So, for example, the measure you see in front of you is about two specific statewide programs. One is our Sentencing to Service program, which places non-dangerous offenders on probation on work crews to perform community service work. And some examples of that are sandbagging, cleaning bus shelters, maintaining trails. They provide thousands of hours of service to Minnesota communities. The other group that's in the figure you see is from our institution community work crews who provide offenders an opportunity to learn new social and work skills while working on a crew to restore communities. And that group of offenders are coming from the institutions, but they're within 24 months of leaving, so they're on their way out. And what they do on those cruises, build affordable homes for low-income families. I think we've done about 300. They rehab homes for low-income families. They do other things like fire containment, etc. But they really do this work for communities. So what you see in front of you is the number of hours that offenders spend working in the sentencing to service work program and the institution work crew slash affordable homes program.
Representative Pat.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Question I have is, I'm taking a look at from, you know, 05 to 08, and my idea here is that we have more offenders that are currently incarcerated today than there were in 2005. And I'm wondering why we saw a 300,000 hour, you know, because it's 1.09 million hours, 1.39, why that significant drop in those number of years?
Ms. Bray.
Madam Chair, Representative, the decline in 06 is due in part to the fact that we used a different method of calculating the hours. We used to include sentencing to service crews in this calculation that the state had nothing to do with. Sometimes the state does all the work with the crews in some parts of the state. Sometimes we have a joint powers agreement, so we share the cost with counties, and sometimes counties do this work themselves. We used to include all of that. Now we don't. We only include work crew hours, sentencing to service hours. We just, the state has a piece, either full or in part. The other part of this, in 2008, we believe part of the decline is we eliminated some of our housing crews. I think we eliminated 8 at the end of FY08. Part of it was a budgetary thing, and the other part was the housing market drying up a little bit. So we aren't able to send as many crews out. Now, I just want to say, as we see what's going on at the housing market, we are looking at what else can we be doing instead. I'm not sure we have come up with a solution to that, and I know we have, and I know we're kicking things around.
Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you answered a couple of my questions. The question I have left is on the work crews. You said that you've moved them, at least in the report, and I think you just said this, that you moved from new construction to construction of supportive housing, remodeling existing homes, and projects to local government agencies. The question is, have local governments, has there been an increase in requests for work crews to come help, whether it's along the highways for garbage collection or whatever, have those requests increased?
Ms. Bray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, I'm going to just check with one of my colleagues. I believe the answer is, when it comes to the sentencing to service crews, I am guessing that those requests probably remain fairly stable, but I'm also guessing that the requests to the institution community work crew, which does the building the homes and rehabbing, etc., have decreased.
Ms. Bray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Ken Merce from our department has just said that we really, with the housing program, we work in collaboration with the communities, and fundamentally it is the requests are slowing down because the money isn't there on their end to put in. Have I stated that correctly?
And Ms. Bray, you can feel free to permit someone else to come to the table to actually speak to us directly rather than relaying, if that would be much easier.
Madam Chair, thank you. I will. I'd be much more comfortable. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're talking about measures here, and we're looking for results, I believe, on what's happening. When you send these individuals out to work in the communities, do we get any feedback from the communities to say that you just saved our county
you've just saved our city so much money, or you've given us a valuable entity there that we really can't live without. Or you've done so well, and I don't see anything in the paperwork that we have to get some kind of feedback of the dollars in value that the counties get out of this, the cities get out of this, that the state actually gets out, because it's for the state, but we're utilizing the corrections facilities on the people there to do that. Do you get anything like that back?
Ms. Bray.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, we do. You know, some other measures that we collect that we don't have in here, and I'm not sure what the history is on that, but I'll just go over 2008 very briefly. I won't even give you the numbers unless you want them, but I will tell you that we collect the numbers that have participated in the program. We collect the number of jail bed days saved, because that's part of the purpose of this, is to help save jail beds. We collect the value of the work that the offenders do if they were to be paid at $6 an hour, which they aren't in the case of STS crews. And we collect the dollar value of the fines that they work off by doing STS work. We likewise collect similar measures for the work, the housing program. I will also say that I have a file that I'm building now, and I'm new, so it would be thick if I had been around a while, with newspaper articles that we see all the time related to the work that these crews have done and the good jobs. And I could give you a lot of anecdotal stories about that. We get that feedback all the time. We haven't built it into any kind of a measure.
Follow up, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I think for our benefit, not only just seeing what you've done and how you've calculated what you have here, to just maybe add that to your presentation would give us a better overall picture of what the state gains from that.
Ms. Gray, I actually would recommend or request that you submit what dollar amounts that you believe that you saved and what dollar amounts, because it would be helpful for us to actually measure that. Not so much the anecdotal, but whatever data that you have that would be helpful to this committee, I would recommend that you send that to us. And then I do have another question for you as well. Mr. Carter.
Madam Chair, in relation to Representative Anderson's questions, I was just checking the 1996 performance report for corrections, and they did include it. They had the number of hours worked, the actual, the targeted, and then the value of the hours worked. And I think they put a $5, at that time it was $5 per hour. And at that time it was, you know, $3.2 million that was calculated. But once again, this is, you know, over 10 years ago. But it was in the 96 performance report.
And Ms. Bray, my last question for myself would be, did you meet the target that you had for this year? Ms. Bray.
Madam Chair, Representatives, what I'm doing right now is just looking to see if I can find where the target is. I thought I wrote it down here, and it may be.
Ms. Bray, let me help you.
Thank you.
The target was 1.2 million hours.
Thank you. No, Madam Chair, Representatives, no, we didn't. And in fact, I think, and I'm just thinking now, I'm not finding the data, I think we may have even lowered. I think, are you, Madam Chair, are you referring to the target for 09, fiscal year 09?
Fiscal year 08.
Okay.
That's right. And so, Ms. Bray, those are the kinds of things that we want to, I as the chair of this committee want to set targets, one that you can reasonably meet as the department, and two, that are helpful measures for this committee. And so those are the kinds of questions that I'm going to be asking throughout the rest of this time. And just so you know, if you don't have them today, you know, maybe reasons why the targets weren't met might be helpful as we determine what the targets should be for next time, so that we want to be measuring something that's helpful to this committee, and we want to make them reasonable. So, Ms. Bray.
Madam Chair, representatives, just to jump back for 1 minute to Representative Anderson and the chair, I agree. I think we could be and should be, and we have the information to report that you requested, and so we will do that in the future. I hear you telling us you'd like us to do that. We will do that. Just to your point, Madam Chair, our target for FY09 is actually a little bit lower than the business we did in FY08. It's 1.05, and the reason for lowering that is because we're anticipating we might not get the request for the housing crews that we once had, so we'll see.
All right, please, questions? Representative Olin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. It's not really a question. It's just it's an observation coming from Pennington County Law Enforcement in the past. I know that you've had work crews up there, and I know that you can find the sheriff and a few other people that will give you a high rating for the work crew work that was done up there.
All right, Ms. Bray.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you.
Please continue.
I will. The second focus area is to optimize our use of best practices, and we do this in two ways: promoting the use of evidence-based practices all around the state and increasing offender participation in our reentry services. I want to talk first about how we're going about promoting best practices. In 2004, with the support of the National Institute of Corrections, we put together an evidence-based practices policy team, which at that time was a pretty unique collaboration between Minnesota's three correctional service delivery systems and our state correctional institutions. The team works in partnership with networks that we have all over the state, and they focus on the following best practices: training and developing and promoting the use of offender assessment tools. We use throughout the state now tools to help us, that give us an indication of the risk to reoffend level for each offender. We promote and use motivational interviewing and dynamic case planning. We use gender-specific best practices, especially for female offenders. We use cognitive behavioral interventions. We use reentry planning that starts at day one, and then we use specific pre-release and treatment programs. Research shows that correctional agencies can reduce recidivism by the systematic integration of a set of principles that lead to the practices I just mentioned. So in corrections, those practices, risk assessment tools, motivational interviewing, case planning, are key best practices.
Someone has their cell phone on? All right, Ms. Bray.
The DOC has one person who coordinates and provides much of the training in evidence-based practices throughout the state. I'm going to talk about recidivism in just a minute, because that is so important to everything we do, and I think if there were just one measure for us to really pay attention to, it would be that. But before I talk about recidivism, I'd like to talk about our goal in this area, our second goal, which is to increase offender participation in reentry services. Successful transition from incarceration to the community is a critical factor in recidivism reduction, and it's a high priority for our department. We know that offenders have to be successful during the first few months after release if they're going to remain crime-free. We also know that reentry begins well before release. So we have reentry resources available at all the DOC facilities to assist inmates in pursuing educational opportunities, maintaining physical and mental health, obtaining personal IDs, establishing sound personal finances, etc.
We also have facility staff who partner with a wide variety of community organizations in order to get that information to offenders. We do it through transition fairs, family law clinics, child support workshops, etc. You can see from the graph that the number of offenders participating in reentry classes, and this is within the institution, continues to rise. This is another instance where...
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, you say that the increase, Ms. Bray, you say the increase of number of people participating in reentry classes, but you don't give an overall number of those that it sounds like could participate but don't. You're saying that it's an increase, so you went from 2033 to 3058. How many could have participated in, say, in fiscal year 06 or 07? How many could have participated in this reentry class versus that didn't?
Ms. Bray.
Madam Chair, Representative, it isn't in our report, it could have been. I can give you that information and I can give it to you verbally or I can give it to you in writing later on if you'd like. I can tell you overall, between 05 and 08, the percentage varies from 42% to 57% of offenders who are eligible for pre-release programs and who actually participate in pre-release programs. Now, there are all kinds of little caveats with that, but that just gives you an idea.
We've got a list here. So first, Ms. Representative Anderson, if you have a follow-up. All right, Representative Hornet.
Madam Chair, I guess what troubles me about the report is just too many pieces of information missing. What I thought it was going to be as a performance report, not a diagram of what you are doing or what the status is. But in each case, if we would have had a goal, how far you came, in each one of these, if it would be not just a graph, but how many could have you have done, how many of you are doing, it would have made it more complete. It would make me see where you are rather than just a description of the programs. It's more like an overview of the department to me than a performance report in this form. Here, so.
All right. I don't know if you wanted to comment, but otherwise I have another question. Representative Bingham.
Thank you. I'm looking at one of these different charts, so I fairly certainly have this right. More offenders have participated in the reentry classes, yet recidivism has either leveled off or just slightly increased. Theory is, and I'm a big believer in the reentry program, but the theory is that if more people were in these programs, then recidivism should theoretically have gone down. So I guess the natural question is there something with the programming that is not hitting the results that you are looking for? And if that is the case, then I guess, Madam Chair, at some point I would like more overview, and I'm sure we'll get to this at some point, of your more thorough review of the reentry program. So correct me if I'm wrong.
Ms. Bray.
Madam Chair, Representative, just to address your last point now, we have a person here who heads up the reentry program, and he could come up now and give you an overview, or we could provide it to you later. But I think your bigger concern was your first question in tying this to recidivism, and I would just respond by saying I think everything we're showing you is tied to recidivism, but we aren't able to unpack it. And so the degree to which this is increasing, as well as the degree to which recidivism seems to be increasing, is an issue. But I would just point out to you, our reentry effort, which we call MCORP, is fairly new. And it's the first time we've really said there is a way to do reentry right, and we need to start doing it. And so part of the increase in pre-release classes is the recognition that we have to get started early with these guys. In fact, we should start right at the beginning at day one, and we have done that now with a group. So I guess all I would offer is that, I hate to say this, but as we go down the road with our reentry effort and everything else that we're working on, I really hope recidivism
does go down, and I think for FY09, we targeted 30% for reconvictions, and I'll have to look at my notes, but we set our targets fairly low.
Follow-up, Representative Bingham. And I apologize, somebody must have put a quarter in me today, Madam Chair, for all the questions.
Less than that.
Oh, okay. But, and I'm glad that I had the theory right. There is no doubt I can say that I think most people support that we bring the recidivism rate down. There is no doubt that people understand that. So I guess what I would like is, again, that if we can go through some of these programs to see if we can't help you get to that end, because I think in the end, we all share that goal. So let's see what we can do together to make sure that that happens. And I think that's what the chair's goal is here, is to go through these so that we are having the most accountable programming, so that we are getting the best results, so that we are lowering crime and kind of that revolving door.
Representative Cass.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Looking at this here, we're talking about reentry classes and what they're trying to do. My question is pretty simple about the definition of participation. And that is, by saying that somebody is participating, are they completing the reentry class, or is it that they are enrolling and then kind of falling off the wagon there? I think it's important to see that any sort of a good program is full completion, and that somebody is following through on every obstacle that you put in front of them in order to make this work and to decrease decrease recidivism. So I'm wondering, does participating mean that they finish the course?
Ms. All right,
Bray. Madam Chair, Representative, may I call a colleague?
You may. Please come to the table and state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, Representatives, I'm Gary Johnson. I'm the Director of Reentry Services for the Department. Just to speak to the question, the pre-release class that we're talking about is a three-day event that offenders go through at about the six-month point before their release. And it's a mandatory class. So it is a class that all offenders finish. There may be some that don't finish for specific reasons, but it isn't a voluntary class that they're attending. I hope that answers the question.
Follow-up, Representative Cass.
So then what I'm looking at is that, why is this an indicator then of to increase offender participation? If you're forcing participation, how is this an indicator then of any sort of best practice that, this is offering some sort of hope that recidivism is going to go down? I guess I'm trying to find the tie here about that. If you're forcing people into this, why is it a good indicator when you could just tell us flat out 100% of people are participating and therefore we hope this helps?
The increase in numbers is really indicative of our ability to identify those offenders who should be going through this program. This is relatively new. It's only been around for a number of years, 2004, I believe. And so we started at just several institutions to begin with, and we have evolved this particular kind of transition programming over that time. And I think that's an indication of why the numbers are going up. Tying this particular kind of transition programming is kind of difficult to do because it's only one stage of the kinds of events that need to go on in corrections in order to be able to really get a clear indication of whether recidivism is being reduced. A person moves through their corrections experience in the institution, going through programming, which also affects how they're able to successfully or unsuccessfully reenter. They go through educational classes as programming in our institutions. That also bears on their ability to reenter successfully. And then they have to develop a case plan for themselves once they're released. That programming has just recently begun with our MCOR reentry initiative. And I can talk about that at a later time. I think it probably would be best. But the point is there are many parts of the institutional experience that bear on someone's ability to be successful when they reenter, and to simply focus on this particular class as being a way to connect to whether or not we're successful in reducing recidivism is not really the right way to do it.
Representative Johnson.
I'll pass, Madam Chair.
Representative Cole.
Maybe you said this and I missed it, but do you have numbers comparing recidivism rates for individuals who have gone through the reentry programs compared to those who haven't?
Mr. Johnson.
I don't believe that we do, Representative Cole.
Madam Chair, I think that would be some rather useful information if we're going to evaluate the effectiveness of the reentry programs currently being done by the department. I'd like to know, I don't know if that's going to be all telling, but it might be, it's a useful piece of information, I think.
Mr. Carter?
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, I think the same information has been asked by the network. This was a group that we gave $1.6 million for recidivism. And I think they're supposed to give us some information on their recidivism. And this is a, sort of like their reentry program. So,
Representative Bingham.
I have a general question. Do you have internal auditors that work within your department?
Ms. Bray?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know the answer to that. I certainly can get back to you.
Well, we're waiting. Representative Mason, did you have a question on this point of recidivism or...
Yes. I'm sorry.
Representative Mason, go ahead, Chair.
I'm not sure you'll be able to answer this, but I remember around 1995, there was a program to address hardcore female recidivism called Project Hope. Was that effective at all? How is your program in comparison to that?
Ms. Bray.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not familiar with that program, but I'd be happy to do the research and get back to you.
Thank you, Ms. Bray. Follow up to Representative Bingham's question. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, my name is Lisa Cornelius. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Support Services Division. Yes, we do have one internal auditor. He primarily focuses on financial audits. However, we do use him for program audits also. I'd also like to say a couple words about, it might help give the committee a little bit of background. When our strategic plan and a lot of these measures were developed back in 2004, we based a lot of them on data sets we currently had and we could collect, realizing that most of these do require a research component to actually show you if they're effective or not. Unfortunately, we didn't have resources back then. Most of our research unit was decimated in the budget cuts that happened in 2003. So we tried to do the best that we could with the data we were currently collecting. However, now we do have resources for doing research, and we have begun doing that. The question about does reentry help? We are starting research on having a controlled group of people who are not going through the MCORP program versus offenders that are. So we are working on this, and we do want to update these. And even some of those targets we established back then, we do realize a lot of this is based on more accounting data than the performance issues.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Cornelius, Mr. Carter just said that he had some information on a question that I had asked earlier that was documented back in 1995 or 98, somewhere back in there. So there must have been somewhere along the line that we've been doing some documentation within the Department of Corrections. And then because of lack of funding, you cancel these programs or to stop collecting information regarding this? So, I mean, it seems like once you start doing something that you'd want to have that to give you credibility to those who you come to for your finances. It just seems unreasonable that you would throw that all away.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, you're absolutely right. We would love to be able to continue to collect all the data all of the time and to be able to do the research. But sometimes when we're in difficult economic times, we have to make decisions, and sometimes you have to trade off a research position for a correctional officer in a prison.
All right. I have a follow-up question to this slide about best practices.
Can you tell me what percentage of the programming that you're using is best practices? And what was your target, and did you meet it in terms of recidivism? Ms. Bray.
Madam Chair, representatives, I'm not sure. No, I can't give you that answer right now. What I can tell you, and I don't think this is exactly what you're looking for, is that we really have infused best practices throughout our whole department. I can tell you everything we do in the field with agents who are supervising offenders, we use best practice now. We used to just do what we always did. We use best practices all throughout the facilities. We use best practices in how we do our financing. We're using best practices in HR. But I wouldn't want to give you a percentage because I'm not sure it would be, you know, I wouldn't know what the percentage is.
Well, I would suggest that you start looking in the future because I'm going to have a bill mandating that you implement best practices to a certain percent, and it would be nice to know how much might be too much for me to push for in a short period of time. Representative Coles.
Madam Chair, for either you or the witness, where are these best practices coming from?
Ms. Bray.
Madam Chair, representative, a better word, I think, is evidence-based. It comes from research, and it used to be we didn't have a lot of research that talked about what to do with offenders that worked, which is why we just did what we always did. But I would say starting about 1960, I think things really started to change. I think technology was a big factor in all that, but more and more research was being done looking at different programs, and then meta-analyses were begun, and those are like a survey of all the studies in any one topic area. And so those meta-analyses is really where we have our best information about what works with offenders and what doesn't. And I think our whole community now is very well versed on that body of knowledge, and that's where we get our evidence-based practices from.
Madam Chair,
Representative Paul.
I'll be in your bill. I'm not sure that I understand yet kind of where that's coming from. I mean, it's best practices for the Department of Corrections in Minnesota from their perspective may be different than what we believe that their best practices ought to be. It may be different than what's happening in Wisconsin or North Carolina. And I'm just not sure. I'll be interested to see your bill and see how you attempt to find best practices.
All right. Thank you, Representative Coles. But my second question, Ms. Bray, was about your recidivism rate. And the question I'm going to ask you throughout this process is, what was your target, and did you meet it on recidivism, Ms. Bray?
Madam Chair, representatives, I think with that I'll move on and just start to open up the conversation, and I'll directly address your question. I would like to say one more thing. We are in the process of an evaluation of our reentry effort using an experimental design. We hope to have the first part of that done by this time next year on our Phase 1 offenders, and we hope to have a full report done by the summer of 2010, and that's with all the offenders. So, stop me if I am saying way more than you want to hear, but I just want to introduce the topic of recidivism by saying that is the gold standard, I think, in our business. But there's a huge problem when we use it, and we all know that. We aren't the only ones that contribute to the recidivism rate. There are so many other factors involved with that. Having said that, that really is a measure that I think we need to stand on, like it or not. As a direct answer to your question, Madam Chair, I can tell you our target for 2009 is 30% for reconvictions and 22% for reincarceration. And I have to say that I need to look at this chart to see if our target is on here for FY08. For recidivism.
Well, Ms. Bray, we're going to run out of time on this, but let me just tell you, I believe that it takes 3 years to find out if you really set the target on recidivism, because everyone talks about whether people recidivate within a three-year time period or not. So looking back at fiscal year 08, your target for reconviction with a new felony was 32%, reconviction for reincarceration was 23%, and your actual reconviction with a new felony was 36%, and your reconviction and reincarceration was 25%. So that would be for 05, and then 06, your reconviction with a new felony was 30%, that was the target, and your reconviction and reincarceration was 22%, and your actual was 36% for a new felony, and reconviction and reincarceration was 26%. So with that, members, we are going to go into Tuesday. I'm going to ask members that you please keep your handouts in your packets. This is going to continue because at the end of the day, it is my goal for this committee to figure out what it is that we want to have them measure. What is it that the goal should be so that we know what it is that we're getting for the money that we invest in corrections? So, members, please keep that in mind with your questions over the weekend as we move into Tuesday as well. Thank you, Ms. Bray, and I look forward to seeing you back on Tuesday.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
With that, this meeting is adjourned.